You're listening to Spellbound. Welcome to episode 16 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Spellbound is now a CastBox original. It's still available everywhere you typically listen to podcasts, but give CastBox a shot and see what's making it the fastest growing and highest rated podcast app for both iOS and Android.
The number you are calling does not accept unidentified calls.
Our guest today is John Zarzan, author and self-proclaimed anarchist. This guy is super interesting, and so I had to reach out to him. I'm reading his book right now, A People's History of Civilization. For years, he had no car, although he has one now that he shares with his wife. He also has no credit card, no cell phone. His only phone is a landline that is bugged by the government, apparently. And I'm probably bugged now, too, having just spoken with him for over an hour. So there's that. John is a controversial figure because a lot of people find his ideas on how to deal with our planet's problems unrealistic or improbable. And I think this is just not a helpful response to anyone's ideas. John is clearly a very intelligent person. His book I found featured in a very popular bookstore in a very affluent neighborhood in Los Angeles. So this is not just some weirdo living under a rock, although that is by definition what he is. But I found John to be such a delightful person and beyond just a weirdo living under a rock. And I hope to meet him one day and hear more about his ideas. Without further ado, I give you John Zarzan.
Hello.
Hey, John, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I was kind of getting worried there. It was saying that your phone didn't accept calls from blocked numbers. And I guess since I'm calling from the internet, it's a blocked number. But I didn't think I was going to be able to get through.
Oh, I didn't know that. Huh.
I thought maybe it was a security measure or something.
No, well, my phone has been bugged by the government, but...
Well, thanks so much for making the time for this call. I just picked up your book, A People's History of Civilization, and I've been reading it, and I'm on chapter 4 right now. I'm just tearing through it. I'm loving it.
Well, thank you.
Quite a dense book. There's so much information in it. I don't know how all of this information exists in one person's head.
Well, it took a while. Those essays were written and compiled over years. I sort of started in history and kind of ended up a little bit more in anthropology and philosophy, actually. But I tend to go back to history as well. So I'm glad you're enjoying it.
So you're a self-proclaimed anarchist. What does that mean?
Well, I think it's synonymous with anti-authoritarian, with trying to find out what domination is and how to address it, how to remove it, how to get away from hierarchy. And I think green anarchy is what I would identify with, which is more eco-oriented, which is more nature-oriented. It's not about how you run the factories if you think that factories are a big part of the problem.
So a green anarchist, I guess that makes you less of a conspiracy theorist, tinfoil hat kind of guy, and more of like somebody who has concerns about our environmental and economical scenario. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I don't have any conspiracy theory orientation. It's about fundamental things, the roots of this crisis, which it seems to be an all-enveloping kind of crisis from the personal to the social and the environmental. What drives it? You know, where did it start? And I think you go back to basically to domestication. This line of thinking, which involves various opinions, but it's also called civilization critique in a more academic sense. But it questions civilization. They've all died so far. They've all failed. This one is failing. There's only one left, this global civilization that we have now, made up of technology and capital, and seems to be ruling everywhere now, virtually everywhere. That's the problem, in my view.
And you were known, I don't want to spend too much time on this because this isn't what we're here to talk about, but in the 90s, what was your relationship with Ted Kaczynski?
Well, we share a very, very similar critique of technology, and I think it basically comes, and Ted Kaczynski told me this himself, from Jacques Ellul. The book, The Technological Society, that he wrote in the 50s, is available in English since the 60s. And so it was a meeting of the minds. That's when we started corresponding. That is, after he was arrested. I didn't know him before,
You only became friends with him after he was the Unabomber.
Yeah, that's right. And then we started visiting. I went to Sacramento, I don't know, four times or so before the trial, which actually didn't happen. But anyway, Yeah, the lawyers were not in favor of that, so it took us a year to get approval to do that. But anyway, his critique of technology is very sound. I really recommend The Industrial Society and Its Future, the so-called manifesto.
Is that a book he wrote?
Well, 30,000 words. It's a small book, an essay, really. Industrial Society and Its Future, very good stuff. I still recommend it, even though we're not on good terms anymore. But that's very worthwhile.
So how do you get to be on bad terms with the Unabomber?
Well, he doesn't go so far as the civilization critique, and there were some questions about honesty with regarding sources that we kind of fell out over. I disagreed with that. I mean, you can have different opinions, so certainly that's all to the good, but you've got to be faithful to the evidence, and I don't feel he was. He wrote a lengthy critique of the so-called primitivist thinking, which is what I'm basically involved with. Because it does involve, by the way, it involves the primitive. We have a baseline thing for a couple of million years before civilization, which is interesting to look at and which has some radical implications, I think, as far as where we might end up, you know, maybe when the cancer of civilization has run its course and get back to small community face-to-face groups.
So why participate in civilization at all? I mean, even you aren't entirely off the grid.
I don't think we really get to be outside of the dominant order. You know, you don't have a choice about some of these things. I remember, you know, writing about technology in the 80s, and you know, sometimes you'd hear, well, if you don't like this stuff, don't buy it. Don't buy the PC or whatever it is, you know. And, well, rapidly that becomes not an option. It's just the fact. You have to be online. You have to have, you know, you just can't get by otherwise. You can write letters, but no one writes letters anymore. You know, it's just the fact of life. And I don't like it, but there it is. I don't want to just sit in a cave somewhere and be not trying to contribute. So you have to try to navigate these things.
You're right. Yeah, I found myself in a similar spot. I've made my living in digital content for the last 10 years, and I got to a place with it where my life was so saturated with this technology and this way of life where I said enough is enough, and I bought a flip phone and like got off the internet, got off social media for all of last year.
Oh.
But then I realized the same thing that you just said, that I wasn't contributing, and that you can't just go on living like this. The world we live in is a technological one, and if you want to contribute, you've got to be involved with it. And so I've kind of forced myself back into it with this podcast here.
Wow, yeah. And not just us. You know, people are finding that we're not connected. That's one of the main parts of the whole tech thing. You know, well, now we're all connected, but we're not. There's, you know, you keep reading about the epidemic of loneliness, how isolated and alone people are. Hey, it's just the opposite, actually. That's not solving this problem. It's making it worse. You know, and a lot of people, I think, feel that way. But like we both were just saying, you know, you can't just opt out personally. I mean, just individually. For example, my radio show, it streams live, you know. Instantaneous around the world. And I'm very aware if the stream goes down, I'm, you know, blasting our beloved general manager. And then I'm thinking, hey, I'm the big anti-tech guy. And here I am complaining that we don't have the up-to-date tech. You know, it's just trapped in it.
The irony.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm much less prepared for this interview than I am to typical interviews because of how quickly this came together.
Sure.
So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself just for people who may not know who you are?
Oh, okay. Well, I'm a writer, basically, and I go back to the 60s, and I think that's made a kind of indelible mark on me, kind of a child of the 60s. And I was initially involved in something that was pretty formative, Independent Union in San Francisco. And I really learned a lot from that. I wasn't thinking along those lines. And then, I was working on unionism, the origins of unions, and that led on to the question of technology. The technology is a disciplinary thing, sort of along the lines of Foucault, if you will. And that, if you keep going with that, or at least I kept going with that for the 70s, 80s, and so on, you start to run into all kinds of interesting questions. And I began to see the depth of all this stuff. And so basically, I've just been pursuing that. I'm not an academic. I've been working on my own, and I'm pretty glad that I've chosen this path of, as an independent scholar. And I've got 6 or 8 books of a small publisher, and the new one, A People's History of Civilization, also another new one, a much smaller book called Time and Time Again, which is the topic of time. 3 of my major essays on that topic that has just come out.
It wouldn't be fair to not call you an academic. I mean, you've attended some really prestigious schools.
I've never been paid as a professor, although I do sometimes get, guest spots. I spoke at Columbia in this past December, to undergraduate anthropology kids, and that was very cool to be invited by the anthropology department.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're not in the system, but you are recognized by the system, and people like hearing what you have to say about things. So it's, that's what makes you so interesting, because you don't fit the traditional mold of a traditional academic. But yeah, your book is, I'm just tearing it apart right now. I wish I had made it all the way through before we had talked, but I guess it'll be kind of fun diving into this with a little bit of mystery as to where the book is going. And it just came out, right? That last week, A People's History of Civilization?
Right. It's just now available.
But the table of contents was what made me buy this book, just reading the chapter titles. Can I read some of them?
Sure.
Okay, so like there's the introduction, and then there's chapter 1, Agriculture, Domestication, the Cornerstone of Civilization. Chapter 2, Civilization as Patriarchy. 3, The City and Its Inmates. 4, War Enters the Picture. 5, The Bronze Age and the Origins of the 1%. And there's 16 chapters. I won't read them all, but just those first 6 chapters made me buy this book, because I was like, oh my gosh, like when you see everything dismantled and described that way, you can't forget that you saw it.
Oh, wow. I appreciate that.
So what made you write this this book, A People's History of Civilization?
These were various essays written over the years, over many years. They've been updated to some degree. There are 1 or 2 brand new ones, but basically it just occurred to me that if you put these kind of end to end, they make a narrative, a chronology, and that's, it really is a history of the West with not too many gaps. So it just took that form that you put them all together in the right order. And I tried to make some links and so forth, just minor stuff, but yeah, I wasn't setting out to write a book when I started writing these pieces off and on, among other work. Then there they were. And so, and I took a look at, well, what's missing? If this is supposed to be a history, what parts are not covered? And I tried to do some of that.
The craziest thing to me is just how you go through and dismantle so many different ways of thinking that are just subconscious ways of thinking for most people. You go in and you describe why people... how different ideologies came into play, like even as far down as like language and mathematics and the motivations that were behind some of these inventions, and just creating order, creating order so that people can be organized and managed very easily. And it's interesting to see. I don't know where the book is going, so in some ways I don't know what direction to take this interview. I'm just curious to kind of talk to you and like kick some ideas around.
Well, one theme I would say, Julian, is that there are certain junctions or times when civilization really is up for grabs, almost, that we shouldn't just assume that this is such a natural, inevitable thing, that there have been challenges, and right from the start, in different ways. And so, I've tried to problematize the whole existence of civilization, because I think that what drives the whole thing is agriculture or domestication. And I think that's rather commonly accepted, but it hasn't been very, very thoroughly addressed, I don't think. So, that's what's behind everything. That drives technology. It's driving the crisis, the environmental crisis, because it's all about control. When we started to farm, when we settled down private property, and all the rest of it flows. And for a couple of million years, we weren't civilized. We were hunter-gatherers. We weren't farming. And, there was an egalitarian ethos. That's, it was very, very striking to me in the 80s. By chance, I came across the whole anthropology literature, and I was just stunned. I had never really looked at it, and you know, it's almost like a utopian fantasy or kind of like anarchists are making this up to push some agenda or something, but not really. People lived in band society, which was face-to-face, sharing, egalitarian. This is textbook anthropology. And I thought, I mean, it just rather quickly, I could see the radical implications. Well, we've only lived in civilization for, you know, 8,000-9,000 years. We've started domestication 9,000 years ago, more or less, and every civilization has failed. And now there's only one. There's just one global, you know, technological unitary thing, and it's failing. And we got to grasp that. We got to just, we're not just along for the ride unless we practice more denial in the face of the, you know, incredible stuff that's going on. You know, the environmental catastrophe is arriving.
Yeah, that's the other frontier. It's not just political. It's not just you know, economical. It's also environmental, and a lot of people are denying that. And it's scary how much denial there is happening right now. There's so much denial.
You just wonder whether we're going to be able, as a species, to kind of wake up and challenge this, or are we just going to do a lot of drugs and just pretend like things aren't so bad as they get worse by the hour, really? I mean, it's one thing I write about, by the way, if I could just stick this in the shootings, the mass shootings. You know, it's absurd to me how superficial the conversation about that is. It's either guns or mental health. The right-wingers stress the mental health part. The liberals stress the too many guns. Well, that really doesn't hardly even touch on the problem. How society gets to this stage where there is no community anymore. It has been erased by mass society. It's not respectable to say that. I mean, you know, I don't get a lot of big TV and stuff to espouse these ideas, to explore this stuff. You know, it's just, but there it is. I mean, I just think it's becoming pretty unavoidable, but, you know, as you say, maybe we'll just keep avoiding it.
Well, denial is only the first stage of grief. We have a long way to go.
Right. Good point.
I think one of the things that drew me to this book when I was looking at the table of contents was I have been this whole last year kind of obsessed with, I've been obsessing over agriculture. And it started when I read this book by Daniel Quinn called Ishmael. Are you familiar with it?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, so reading that book for me was really, it just shocked every part of, I'd never heard the ideas in this book. And like, I kind of grew up in a very small bubble. And like, as I've kind of started putting life together for myself, you know, a lot of things didn't make sense. And Ishmael was like a huge, it kind of just shattered everything. You know, it's just like in a good way, it was just like, oh my gosh, this makes so many things make sense that never made sense before. Like you just said, civilization and agriculture are tied together, and civilization is based on the manipulation of the environment. And it kind of keeps us at odds with each other with, you know, like economy and stuff. And, you know, we're all kind of parasites on each other with capitalism. And just these ideas are so disturbing, but like, I think it's an accurate picture of what's happening. What's crazy is we actually did a series on this podcast after I read Ishmael about the origins of the Bible, because I was blown away by how Daniel Quinn kind of portrays the Old Testament as being inspired by the agricultural revolution. And I talked to a bunch of Bible scholars about this idea, and they actually debunked this, which made me really sad at first, because I was like, oh, well, that's not fun. Like, this idea was really fun, and then they debunked it.
Oh.
But I think that the ideas in Ishmael still hold some weight, because you know, these Bible scholars say that the agricultural revolution happened like way before the earliest Old Testament writings show up. But that doesn't mean that the writings couldn't have been fueled by it. I mean, the agricultural revolution would have been a huge beat point in human evolution. So like, we would have been dealing with the repercussions of that in early civilization for thousands of years, probably. It would have been a very slow adaptation. So it's not that far-fetched, you know, even though there's a couple of thousand years between the revolution and the earliest Old Testament writings, it still seems pretty feasible that they could be, maybe not like derived directly from each other, but inspired by loosely it doesn't seem that crazy.
No, I think you're right. Yeah, it's there. I mean, the origins of monotheism, I mean, you know, that's part of the logic of it. And then you start, and, you know, sometimes it's a mixed bag, but there's something pretty fundamental that changed. And then you're seeing the different symptoms of it. You know, one of my favorite things along those lines, I think to some degree anyway, is the Adorno and Horkheimer writing about the Odyssey and the famous part where Odysseus is sailing along and the sirens are trying to get, well, they're trying to get Odysseus and his crew to stop and party. And he has his crew, he has their ears stopped up and he has himself tied to the mast so he can avoid the temptation and sail on. Well, he's sailing on to the project of civilization and repression and everything. And they do a very cool little twist on that, that, you know, you sort of assume, well, that these are these horrible libertine sirens, you know, they're trying to tempt these stalwart explorers. But, you know, you could put the value the other way around. Why don't they stop and, you know, instead of moving away from Eros and freedom, they don't want that. They have to avoid that. Otherwise, you don't have civilization. You've got to repress all that stuff. So, you know, that I think that's, you know, Homer, it's like, what, 9th century BC or something. That's probably around the time, roughly speaking, of some of the biblical writings. But there you see it again. You know, this is not the... maybe they could have stopped. They could have aborted that mission to sail on and establish a repressive way of life, but they didn't. Instead of celebrating it, we could mourn the fact that they didn't stop and have a good time and avoid work and war and everything else that comes with civilization.
Right. Yeah, I've noticed when I talk to people, when I attempt to have casual conversations about civilization and whether or not it's good or bad with people, I'm sure you found the same thing, because I find it to be almost the unanimous response. It's that people get overwhelmed by the idea of civilization being a bad thing. And it's like they don't want to do the mental work involved with kind of auditing it in your head and just kind of like thinking about all the different... repercussions of agriculture and economy, and not that all of these things are bad in and of themselves, but just paying attention to like what the knee-jerk response is to those things and how that keeps us stressed out and sick. And and people don't like thinking about civilization as a bad thing. Have you found that?
Well, yeah, I have. And another part of it that possibly even trumps that is simply the inertia of it all. I remember I was in Turkey once, and this woman was arguing with this fellow about civilization, and with in a very lucid, cogent way. I thought I was just hearing it. And anyway, the guy said, finally, he said, well, I think you're probably right. Probably every single thing you said is right. But you might as well argue against the sun coming up. In other words, it's a done deal. It's you can't do nothing about it. So it's interesting, but only in a kind of academic way. He wasn't disputing it. He was just saying, so there it is. You know what I mean? It's just too big of a reality.
Yeah, that's the other response you can
have. That's the other main one, I think. Yeah.
But, I think it's helpful to talk about this stuff. It's maybe I'm just a weirdo, but I don't find this stuff to be scary. I mean, what could potentially happen if we don't address some of these problems is scary. But talking about it, I mean, we live in the advantage of the digital age and the advantage of the internet is that we can all swap ideas in real time. You know, we our ideas are no longer confined to the biological constraints of our minds and like who is immediately around us. We can share stuff with people all over the world instantly. And that's a really powerful tool, especially with the size of the problems that we have to navigate right now. And so I think it's exciting to talk about this stuff. I think talking about it is what people should be doing, which is what led me to start this podcast, just to kind of like learn a lot about different things that are happening in the world and try to you know, just get people talking about it, because I've found people don't want to talk about this stuff because they find it to be too much mental work or too heavy or too depressing or something. But like, we've got to change how we see this, because whether or not people are aware of it, they're living in a very comfortable bubble right now that is going to change. Whether or not it's like a small crash or a big crash, like crashes in civilization happen all the time. And, you know, it's like these people, I think America specifically is due for a big wake up call, especially with VR and AI, and I don't think people really know what's coming in the next 5-10 years.
Right. It seems to be coming with an accelerating speed. Yeah, I think you're right. That presents this even more starkly. And, you know, you can also say all of us are still relatively comfortable in our bubble and everything, but you know, there's a lot of visceral sadness, and the opioid crisis is just gigantic, and you know that tells you about despair, and the numbers there that are dying of putting the needle in the arm, and again the mass shootings. I mean, it's not like everything is so fine, it's just sailing along. Mm-hmm. Everybody's on drugs of some kind, legal or illegal. You know, it's not that happy a scene. And, you know, one thing I've noticed, that, which is kind of maybe we could say our enemy speaking, I'm thinking of Daniel Pinker. He wrote The Better Angels of Our Nature, and his newer one is Enlightenment Now. And it's just a brazen, straight-up defense of civilization. You know, everything is fine, everything is getting better. And this newest one especially has gotten savage. It's just like, what are you talking about? I was somewhat surprised at the negative reviews. But it's interesting, in general, I think, that why do these people have to make this defense? They do, because it's under threat, because people maybe are starting, at least on some level, to be not so happy about it. Otherwise, why would you bother to, you know, make these big claims which really don't hold up? So, you know what I mean? That tells you that the other side is feeling the heat. They're not sleeping that soundly, perhaps. You know what I mean? So that's interesting in itself, I think. 2 months ago, I was in Austin for this biohacks conference. And these are the transhumanists, the people that are so in love with the technological future. You know, all this implants and, speaking of AI, and specifically body hacks, literally becoming cyborgs. You know, it was incredible. I was invited.
I'm assuming you're not a fan of this whole becoming cyborgs thing.
Oh, I think it's just incredibly unhealthy and crazy, you know. And when they invited me, I said, there must be some mistake. I loathe this whole direction. It's so fucked up. And they go, no, that's right. We know. That's why we want you to come and duke it out. And so there was this debate and everything. And I'm still pinching myself. I mean, you could say, well, you know, the critique of all this is sort of remote. You know, it isn't. I mean, these are CEOs and lots of other people there. And they were friendly as anything. And I kept saying, why are they paying me to come and just destroy this guy, which, frankly, I can easily do. I can poke the holes in every single lie that you know, about being connected and all the rest of it. It's just simply not true. All the claims and promises of the high-tech future are just, you know, so many lies. And anyway, I don't know what this portends, probably nothing. But I went, and I really enjoyed it. I just talked to all kinds of people, and they really seemed to be listening, and you know, we had a good thing. It wasn't like personally nasty in any way, but you know, it was a full-on fight, if you will. So
interesting.
I thought that was interesting. Maybe that's I don't know. You know, we all change our ideas. We all, as we grow, you know, you discover new things and new thoughts, like certainly you have and I have over the years. I mean, I'm not writing these people off completely, as much as I find that whole thing so abhorrent. I mean, really, it's not the way to go. We're moving away from the earth. We're moving away from each other. We're just creating all these horrible things, and you want more of it? My God, you know. Anyway, I just popped into my head. I thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, you've talked a lot about lies that exist in our society that people kind of just go along with, and I feel like when you use the word lies, not you specifically, but just in general, people tend to kind of go into conspiracy theory mode. Like they think you're just some tinfoil hat, like everybody's out to get me kind of person. It's almost like lie isn't the right word. It's almost like consumer confidence. Cause you know, like the dollar is kind of a lie. It's not really worth anything. Every currency's fiat now. So there's nothing backing it, but we all agree on this lie that a dollar is worth a dollar, and so it is. But the moment that a dollar ceases to be worth that, then it crashes, you know. So it's almost like that we're heading towards the same thing with these, you know, with technology and the environment. It's not that there's some global, like, you know, lizard people organization that's like running things and, you know, everybody's a slave. It's that people...
No, you're right. That's a good point. I mean, there are examples you could possibly argue. For example, I think of these big high-tech CEOs and stuff, and the interesting thing about how many of them send their kids to, like, the Waldorf school, you know, these anti-tech places. They don't want their kids drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
So on some level, there is a lie in there. But I think you're right. It's not helpful to put it in those terms because it's a cultural thing. It isn't just, you know, people crafting, even though they might be manipulative in terms of how do we get, you know, people more addicted to all these devices. There's certainly some of that, but it's a much deeper question than that, whether they do or not, you know, whether they're trying very consciously to more or less enslave people. It doesn't really matter because the thing itself, the whole train of technology delivers the goods, whether or not they, you know, I mean, if nice people or evil people or whatever, it really doesn't matter. You might view them as a party and don't think they're fine. They're cool and everything, but that's not the point. It's the same with cops. It's not a personal thing. It's what they represent, what they basically enforce, you know, not if they're nice or not.
Right. Like if technology is a distraction from each other and nature and the things that we should be focusing on, then it wasn't handed to us with some ill intent. It's like, we're all just, people are fumbling through life together, trying to like survive. And at some point along the way, we invented agriculture for whatever reason. And that's what's the craziest. That's what's so crazy about your book is it takes something like technology and it says like, this is why, you know, it's all based on patriarchy and agriculture, and you know, these original messages, these original motivations for agriculture and order in society are still around and very apparent in even new inventions. Because it's all just a residual effect.
Mm-hmm. I think it is. Yeah. The logic is there, the inner logic, one might say. It's not, there is a consistency, and it increases control deeper and wider and so forth. And you get nanotechnology and, you know, all these other things. It's the same game. It's just more sophisticated and increasing its reach, and which is really rather the opposite of the way we used to live as Homo species for, you know, 2-3 million years.
So if it all goes back to the agricultural revolution, I mean, what do you think the original motivation was for, you know, if we were hunter gatherers and we just discovered that we could like plant food in the ground and then seeds in the ground and that food would come out. You think that was that the motivation for agriculture was that pure? Do you think it was, you know, there was some intent behind it that we don't know about? What do you think about it?
Well, I think people already knew that. It wasn't a big discovery. I mean, so many these ethnological studies show various kinds of evidence that people, they had an amazing communion with nature and intimacy with nature, and the slightest changes in the landscape and all that stuff. It wasn't like, oh, they suddenly discovered you could grow things. I mean, they knew that for thousands of generations, I think. But what happened, and this is still an intriguing question, why people wanted to become sedentary and, you know, establish private property and settle down and farm. It's, you know, there's one of the things that's a little bit left out. It still is left out quite a bit, but there was a struggle involved. There was a really massive battle, if you will. I mean, who's the name of the, trying to think of one of the cardinal sources I have on that, that called it a titanic struggle. It wasn't just like freely, well, let's just do this. This sounds cool. Let's try this. No, it was a huge amount of resistance. And, you know, to some extent, that's still going on in far-flung places, you know, people avoiding that. James Scott writes about it in terms of upland Southeast Asia, where people try to stay away from government control. And, I mean, some of it, it's not that much of a left, of course, but, you know, in other words, there was opposition. There were people that didn't want that. They wanted to remain somewhat more mobile and take what nature gives instead of enforcing, you know, instead of colonizing nature and making the earth work, you know, is one way to put it.
So you think that the whole initiative came out of putting the earth to work, putting the earth and its resources to work, making a product out of it?
Well, yeah, and you can see that, like, if somebody does that, whatever the circumstances or motivations are, a lot of this we'll probably never be able to really know, but, you know, you have a plot of land, you weed it, you tend it, and so forth, and then some hunter-gatherer comes along and picks your fruit or whatever, and you scare them off, you make a fence, you get a spear, you know, because you did the work. And so you have a right to, you know, that's private property.
Right.
And other people, you know, do not want the fixed boundaries or being tied to the land, you know, the drudge work that goes on, what happens with children. You know, we lose our sensual acuity because you don't really need that for farming. Here are one or two kinds of weeds. You can have kids out there pulling the weeds. You don't have to learn about different species or different plants and all the slight changes that we have no idea about. They're so subtle, but, you know, we've lost that. And it's, you know, you're trading one for the other. And, you know, again, there were people that did not want to go that way. And so that battle has raged, you know, especially way back when.
It almost seems like it's all based on the idea of leisure. If you do the work to grow this food, and then you can sell leisure to people because people don't have to go looking for that food or to grow it themselves. And so, you know, agriculture is supposed to give people more free time, I guess, is the idea. But it almost does the opposite.
Right, exactly. Marshall Solins makes that point, and he just raises it as a question, as a kind of empirical datum, what you just said. How come civilization means more and more work? Always more work, always less leisure time. And we see it now, you know, two adults in the family, they're both working. They didn't used to have to both work.
Right.
I mean, gee, with all the technology and the, you know, advance of civilization, it's not making it better. I mean, in some ways, sure, you can find things that are, you know, most people would say are positive, but the basic stuff, you know, the freedom, the leisure, all that, that's out the window.
And sure, people used to die a lot more and life was a lot more brutal back then, but also, you know, our soil had more nutrients because we weren't just farming the hell out of regional areas and then like not doing anything with the rest of it. And then like just our soil is so nutritionless now that our food is probably like, it had to have been way healthier for us way back in the day.
Oh yes, for sure. And you know, archaeology has done some debunking of the thing that everybody was dead by the age of 30. There was a significant amount of childhood infant mortality, that is. But if you survive that, people commonly lived as long as we do. But what skews it is the, you know, when you factor in the people that, you know, didn't survive infancy, which is higher than it is now. But, you know, so some of these things are don't bear up under a lot of scrutiny. And not to, you know, create some myth that everything was perfect, you know, of course not. But yeah, and like you point out, the nutrients in the soil, then you become more reliant on technology because the earth has been impoverished, and then you're more dependent on the tech solutions in any area you think of. And And, you know, when you think about these areas, what one of the things that cracks me up is the promise of technology. One of the main ones is, yeah, there are a lot of problems, but, you know, we're advancing. We're going to fix that. We're going to heal that. We're going to solve that. Well, when you think about it, the technology has created the problem that then they come around to claim they're going to solve.
That's
in a general sense.
Yeah.
It's always true. I mean, cancer, or, you know, you could think of a lot of examples. It's like a shell game. Well, let's see, you create the problem, then you come out front and say, we're going to fix it. That, you know, on the face of it, it's screwy. You know, it's just not, doesn't bear up.
Well, there was, my buddy he was on the podcast a couple weeks ago, and he was saying that for the very first time ever, somewhere in California, I can't remember where, I think it was in Northern California, they produced more solar energy than they needed in a month. And they were able to, like, apparently technology was for the first time able to offset its own environmental costs. But you wonder how far that's going to be able to go. I mean, solar energy makes sense that it's, you know, because you're just capturing power from the sun, and it's not like you're not burning fossil fuels. But you're right that the technology created the problem in the first place. So it does seem kind of curious that they're going to be able to fix all of the problems they've created with the creation itself. It doesn't seem likely.
It doesn't seem likely. And you know, to take solar as an example, it's an extremely toxic process to create those panels. And then it's another very toxic problem when they burn out. I mean, sometimes, you know, that's left out of the equation. And the fact that in order to get that energy, you've got to have an industrial infrastructure.
That's true.
You know, they're industrializing the desert right out by Palm Springs and other places. I mean, you know, well, I guess it's more, what is it, Death Valley, these enormous solar farms. So when you add it reminds me of the thing about Prius cars, you know, they're less polluting, right? Well, they are less polluting to drive, but what does it take to build that car? You know, they commonly leave that out. That's an enormous blow, you know, an enormous impact environmentally. And they act like those cars just come down from heaven.
Hey, don't rag on my Prius, man.
I wish I had one. No, I, you know, but I mean, you can leave certain things out of the picture and make a very rosy deal, and it ain't so rosy.
No, you're totally right.
Look at the whole thing.
You're totally right. And the Prius does use some recycled materials and stuff like that, but there's still an environmental cost, is what you're saying. And you're right. There is an invite. Those, they don't just come down from heaven. They, you know, they're digging resources out of the earth to make those cars, and they sell like crazy. There's like what, 8 different Priuses now that I see on the roads. It's like, it's crazy.
Wow. Uh huh. Hey, when did you get to LA, by the way? I'm curious.
I've lived in LA since 2008 or 2009.
Are you okay? You doing okay in LA?
Yeah, things are good. Yeah, I've enjoyed it. Nashville is where I'm from originally. I have a place there that my wife and I are constantly trying to find ways to live because it's just so peaceful there. And we have a house there with a big yard, and you just can't get that in LA.
Yeah.
But, you know, LA is where I work for now. It's where I've started my career. So I've got to kind of be here until something takes me away. Hopefully this podcast will let me live. Maybe I'll move to Germany or something once one day or something. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you're doing good work. You're intensely into it, and I'm happy you are. You're very involved, and, you know, you're going after it, and that's what we need.
Yeah. Well, I'm just, you know, to me, it's just fascinating because I feel like a lot of people in America grow up in a bubble, and you're not, you're raised not to question things and just to like participate in politics, decide if you're left or right, decide if you want to shop organic or not, decide if you want to, you know, there's all these like ideas that you've got to like come to terms with, and they're synonymous with becoming an adult. And then you find yourself living this life where you've got all these ideas about how you should live, but yet things still don't seem to go the way you're planning. And people are like, your friends become increasingly polarized as you get older because political views tear them apart and religious views tear them apart. And there's all these agreements that we make in civilization that just keep people at odds with each other, only, you know, only increasingly so. Like my parents, a lot of their old friends, like I've become friends with now, and my parents aren't friends with some of these people anymore because of just differences in how they see the world. And it's just sad how these agreements can tear people apart and also keep us at odds with the environment and stuff. And so I've just kind of like, I'm obsessed with this topic right now, and I'm just reading a lot about civilization and I'm curious about where people think it's going and what the solutions are going to be, because I think we're going to have to get really creative in the next 20 years. Humans are going to have to do a lot of work to survive. I think survival is going to be really challenging for the next 20 years. We're going to see technology turn everything on its head, and we're going to be like, whoa, we've created Frankenstein. You know.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, we got to have the public discussion. We got to have the interaction where we can put certain questions on the table and you know, get past the place where, you know, they're boxed out pretty well. There's gatekeepers that just keep these things really out of circulation, and that's maybe changing a little, but it's got to change a lot, or else we're talking about things that are not fundamental. You know, they're just, that's what passes for politics. I mean, look at today. It's just, you know, it's the most absurd, trivial, insulting shit that, why the hell are people talking about this? I mean, well, there are obvious reasons why they are, but, you know, there are the deeper questions, as you imply, that, we better face up to. And because there won't be any solution unless we can have some kind of a social transformation or movement, or, you know, it's not going to be, you know, one or two people yakking about it, you know, like we are. It's going to take a lot, a collective awareness of, we got to have some kind of transition. You know, we got to move away from this, this path we're on.
I think it's so important that we be able to talk openly about anything and everything. There's too many taboo subjects. There's too many things that are not allowed to be discussed, like religion and politics and economics. And people don't want to talk about these things because the reality is we all have differing ideas about how things should be happening. And everybody's entitled to their own opinions, but a lot of people's opinions are going to be shattered in the next 5 years with, you know, as technology progresses and we get some of these things that we're only reading about now, and, you know, when AI is on the scene, like, there's just so many things that are going to come to a head that we're going to have to be able to talk about. And my biggest concern right now is just how off limits certain topics are.
Yeah, I think so. And it's a matter of how things are defined, even, you know, like technology is just neutral. It depends on what you do with it. It's just a tool. That's false. That's not true, in my opinion. And it's political. It's never neutral. You know, it never has been. You know, people were forced into the factories in England in the 18th century, not just because of economics, but to control them. Because people were apt to, when they were scattered around and, you know, doing hand loom weaving in their homes, for example, they were out of the control of the government to a very large degree. They were, you know, more autonomous, and they would riot if they felt like it. Well, you get people exhausted in all those hours in the factories. Well, that's the end of that. It's the opposite of what Marx thought. It domesticates people. It doesn't create some revolutionary group of people. It exhausts them and then tames them. You know, all these things are, I mean, and people know that. They know about work. You don't find a whole lot of people that are in love with work. But, you know, so, you know, to politicize or problematize these things has to happen, or else it won't change. The technology will just become more invasive and controlling and defining, because people will still repeat the old mantra, well, it's just a tool. It's not a tool. It's the whole culture. It's, you know, this is a technological society. Whatever else it is, it's a capitalist society and so forth. But it's, you know, if you don't get to that point, you're not grasping the thing to start arguing about it. You know, you're just suffering under this illusion that that is fine for our managers and the people that are profiting. And really, it's out of control, and it can be controlled. It doesn't, you know, it's not just something that happens from outer space or something. There are people that made this.
What makes technology more than a tool for you? Is it that it's costing the environment something every time we use it?
Well, I think it's a totalizing thing in so many ways. And the environmental part of it is there, but also, you know, again, the disciplinary thing is the carceral part, as Foucault used that word, the kind of imprisonment that you get from all this. It just, it defines the limits. This is what choice means. This is what everything means. You know, that's a given. And, you know, if it's just a given, then you're lost. You're just floating along down the river. You know, and the people will wring their hands. Well, there are ethical considerations, and we should be concerned, and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's a lot of phony talk, because if it's just a tool, if it's just neutral, it will proceed. It does proceed, and you're not even trying to get a grip on it. You know, this used to be different. When the factory owners, and I started doing a lot of work on this way back in the 70s, the people that made these mechanized looms and so forth, you know, for the big workshops, the factories, they were despised. They had to do this in secret. And if the word got out that you were one of those people, people would spit on you and chase you around. Now, these people are lionized, right? They're the big heroes, these characters with all their wealth. And it once was very different than that. They were not beloved, not at all. You know, they were in fear for their lives. You know, the Luddite risings in between 1800 and 1820, that was the really visible part of it. People didn't want that shit. And now we're in this context where it's so totalizing, it's all there is. So, I guess that's how you measure success and value. Well, that didn't happen over, you know, it's not a natural, inevitable process.
So what are like the three biggest problems with civilization in your mind?
Well, I think it's the main features of domestication at base. I mean, I think that is its logic, what drives everything, and it's whether we choose to see it or not, it's a matter of control. And once we lived without control, really, we weren't subject to its definitions and its logic.
What makes control a bad thing?
Well, it's a bad thing in the sense that the logic of it leads to industrialization, which is mass production, which is mass society, which is mass culture. And mass society, I heard a Ute elder say this some years ago in the state of Utah. He said, civilization is the grave of community. That's the biggest thing. It's probably the most fundamental thing to me is community. What happened to it? It's gone. That's why you have the mass shootings, opioid crisis, and all the other horrible symptoms. That's what you have when the social bonds really are gone. People use the word all the time, but tell me where community is.
But that's not I think you're right, but I would say that there are other civilizations, like, you know, in Eastern cultures that have like a strong tribal sense of community. And their civilizations are doing, I mean, I don't really claim to know, but I like to at least think that they're doing better than America.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, look at China. It's just unbelievably, contaminated.
That's true.
Pollutant. People are slaves there. I mean, I've been to India 3 times and that's bad enough, but I've been told, I've never been to China, but that it's even worse.
Yeah, the environment is bad in those places, but you know, I mean, you go to like Italy, for example, and there's a huge sense of community and family there.
Yeah, yep, there still is. When you ask people where they're from, they'll tell you the village, even though they've never lived there. So they want that bond, that tie, but I think it's slipping away. You know, they pay homage to it, but you know, they're on the treadmill just like all of the rest of us. You know, and the technology, they're all plugged into that. What happened to these traditions? I've been in Italy a few times, and I remember one case, I forget where it was, but these people were talking about this, the people from this village were kicked off the land one way or another, you know, economically, and they ended up in these tower blocks apartments. Well, they butchered a pig in this apartment, And people, some people were saying, oh, that's so horrible. These people are not civilized. And, well, but they were trying to hang on to their roots with the land. I mean, they were already farming, of course. They weren't hunter-gatherers. But, you know, if you could look at it a different way, yeah, they're forced to be in the hive like so many other people that once were on the land. You know, it just progresses. And people do want to have it, but I don't know where it is. You know, it's sad, but developers and politicians love the word community, but it's kind of a myth at this point. So if you want community, what defines it? And I think it's face-to-face. If it isn't face-to-face, it's really ersatz.
I agree.
And that's quite a big jump. Good. I'm glad you do. People probably look askance at that. Well, nothing is face-to-face anymore. Yeah, that's the problem.
Well, everything in life is vibration. And this sounds kind of like voodoo, kind of like, you know, like some hippy-dippy kind of stuff. But everything, you know, sound is vibration, or life itself is vibration, energy oscillating between positive and negative. Everything that we experience is a vibration. So if you're not connecting with people face to face, you're not really bonding with them. You're not really playing off their vibrations that they're putting out. You know, the term good vibes, sending you good vibes. You know, you don't get those good vibes or the bad vibes. You don't get any of it without being face to face.
I think so. Yeah. If other people begin to agree with that, then, you know, certain things follow from that. Certain things have to go so that we can be face-to-face again. Because I think that's where, and I think there's a cogent argument there that people can really relate to. If you want personal accountability, personal responsibility, that's gone in mass society. You have to call some expert to come in and fix it for you. But if you're in something like banned society, and I don't mean that's a, you know, literal model, you know, it might be something like that, very much like that. But, you know, and I lived in a housing co-op for 15 years, and it was an hunter-gatherer deal, of course. But, you know, you were across from each other, 40 other people, and somebody fucks up, they have to face the music. Mm-hmm. They know about it. They know about it, and you try to work it out. That's the way we live for so long, and we got to get back to that somehow. If the future isn't somehow primitive, there won't be a future. You know, it's not just a choice. And of course, that's mostly, you know, the environment. But
what makes you say that? Why does it have to be primitive?
Well, because even more primary than domestication, to get back in the weeds a little bit, is division of labor. Specialization keeps increasing, and which is the one thing that's behind even domestication. That's how you get to the stage of domestication. You start getting specialization. You start getting gradients in power among people or authority. And then you're setting the stage for the real viral deal of domestication. In other words,
you're describing a hierarchy?
Hierarchy is involved. And you know, Marx talked about that early on, which he later ditched. I'm very poorly paraphrasing, but, you know, people will be able to fish in the morning and then weave in the afternoon or whatever, and then the next day it'll be... Well, then later, when he fell in love with industrialization, he ditched that. You've got to have division of labor, even though he had said that's the primary problem. That's the deepest social institution and the deepest problem. So, you know, once we probably all had roughly the same capacities and spiritual capacities and all the rest of it, now we don't. And, you know, it's probably started with the shaman, a certain monopolization of these powers, and that starts the road to political authority and hierarchy, like you just mentioned.
So it sounds like you're saying that civilization erodes community because of hierarchy and the fact that capitalism basically makes us all parasites on each other, and that is not compatible with community in its truest sense.
Well, yeah, and I think it is easiest to see with industrial society, with mass society, and various people wrote about this in the 1800s. You know, Durkheim and others wrote about suicide and madness in these new industrial cities, and hasn't gotten better, really. It's gotten shinier and everything, but, you know, fundamentally, it's the massification breaks down community, disperses people, and And, you know, I keep returning to this, but when those bonds are broken, when people are cut off and alone and adrift and you know, then you got nothing much to lose. People pick up a gun and walk to the school and shoot 30 people. That didn't used to happen. You can measure this. I mean, of course, in this country, that where it really happens is the late 90s. It's for real now, and it keeps on going. But, you know, this is not just some arbitrary development. There's roots to this thing, and it's not going to get better. We'd all like to see, well, it's a blip, maybe it'll go away, you know, maybe we're still pretty healthy, blah, blah, blah. Well, really? Tell me what the healthy trends are. I just would like to see some.
Yeah, well, fad dieting, you know, is always changing. I think people always want to be healthier. I mean, in the 90s, it was the Atkins diet and fat-free and, you know, and now we know all that's BS. And, you know, now it's all like eating ketogenic and, you know, having a green juice when you stay up all night just to help your body. You know, it's like people think they can just trash their bodies and then eat healthy and they'll be okay. But
sure.
Well, I mean, and it's not really a surprise, I guess, that when we moved into civilization from hunter-gatherer culture, if I'm not mistaken, one of the key indicators of people who lived in a society as opposed to hunter-gatherer cultures was that they were sick all the time. Maybe it was like, you know, they would get like digestion wasn't good. And, you know, just sick all the time. Like viral illnesses didn't exist before civilization. Am I wrong about that? Or I think I'm right.
Well, yeah, this is the age of chronic conditions, chronic illness. I was looking at television and the ads. You know, if you came from another planet, you'd think everybody here is chronically sick with all of these long-term deals. No, we were much more robust and healthy before agriculture. It's well known, and everything declined. But we all, each of us, I include myself, you know, I remember, speaking of these fads, a few years ago I was reading about how you take vitamin E and selenium every day, you never have cancer. Well, about a year later, I read you're more likely to have cancer if you ingest these things. I mean, unbelievable. I wanted to believe I'd take some pills and I'm going to ward off disease, but, you know, even though we probably realize it isn't true, but you want to have something, because here we are, we're stuck in this reality. We didn't want it, maybe, but here it is. You know, we're all part of it. We're all held hostage to it.
Maybe the problem is you're thinking about cancer when you eat it.
Ah, there you go. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can definitely think yourself sick.
Well, and that's a cultural thing, isn't it? It's so widespread. The stress, the anxiety, the depression, billions of dollars spent on medicating people. I mean, that's not... where did that come from? That's like an obvious question. Is this the natural state of things? But you motor on, each of us does, and, you know, we can't change it overnight, even though we'd like to. Well, some people don't want to change it, but, you know, it's a harsh reality.
So what do? We can't just go become cavemen. We can't, you know, that's what we said at the beginning of this conversation. We can't just isolate ourselves because that has its own, you know, repercussions. And so what do?
Well, I think we do literally, physically have to go back to something like that, frankly. I mean, that was community. That was connection. You know, this thing, as I mentioned before, offhandedly, sharing and egalitarianism, you know, and I've heard people come back to me after, like, being very skeptical of reference to this kind of thing. I remember this one guy, for example, particularly, he said, I'm taking Anthropology 101 up in Portland. He said exactly what you said. He's just sort of staring at me like he thought I was just some weird anarchist who's just dreaming up stuff, you know. So that's where we got to be. And it's not a matter of just changing your mind about stuff. It's, you know, it's got to be an actual change. And these people that say, well, we just need better, just your thinking has to change. Well, you can change your thinking. That doesn't mean shit. I've changed my thinking. I don't live in a different planet. I'm subject to all this stuff. I mean, you know, Art Bell died last week, and I remember I did 3 hours with him way back in the early aughts, and he was just marveling because, you know, he lived out in the Nevada desert. He did the, you know, the AM, overnight FM or whatever it was called. And he just kept marveling. Like he said, I've got a computer in every room and you don't want computers. You think they should all go away? He couldn't believe it. It was actually kind of fun. I mean, he was less hostile than he was just kind of amazed. We had a good 3 hours, and anyway, yeah, it's, there are a lot of people. Oh gosh, I'm trying to think of the woman who wrote Alone Together.
I've heard of this book.
Yeah. Oh gosh. She spoke here at the University of Oregon, gave this dynamite talk to hundreds of people about the toll of technology on mainly the young. She's part technology, part psychology she's at MIT, with special reference to her daughter, who was 13 at the time. It was spellbinding. It was really powerful. She said, my daughter doesn't even understand in a fundamental way the difference between machines and humans.
Wow.
It, all these incredible things, attention span, 50 other things that just were tragic.
Sherry Turkle.
And then, Sherry, yes, exactly. Yes, yes.
Thanks to my computer for telling me that.
Well, it was quite amazing. And then at the end of this riveting deal, very powerful deal, she said, in effect, she said, oh, well, kind of shrugged and sat down. And I'm not usually such a big loudmouth, but I got to my feet to be first in the Q&A. And I said, oh, well, that's ethically and intellectually bankrupt for you to give us all this stuff and then just say, oh, well. And you could have heard a pin drop. I mean,
wow!
It could have been, who are you? We didn't come here to hear you, meaning me. And of course they didn't. So I'm just shooting off my mouth. And she had nothing to say. And somebody followed up. Well, I don't know if you could say follow up, but how about a moratorium on this whole technological development? And she said, no. Bang. You know, don't even fucking be serious. You know, you can't do that. Well, so why did you spend an hour doing this whole sad, tragic thing and then just say, oh, well?
Well, I think a lot of people get to a place where I think, myself included, I think we all have a limit in how far we're willing to go in a thought exercise towards like what could actually happen if in a worst case scenario. I think a lot of people just kind of have their limit. They can't go any further. And it's understandable.
Well, that might be.
It's understandable. I mean, it's pretty heavy subject matter when you think about what it's suggesting, but that's why I'm interested in what you think we should do, because I haven't finished your book yet.
Well, it's, you know, if you want to reconnect with people and the earth, then you don't think this stands in the way of that? She does. And I have no respect for people like that. They make a lot of money peddling this, but out of the other side of their mouth, they're completely down with the whole sorry project. They know what it causes. And I've read her other stuff too. And, it's amazing. I mean, it's just filled with these stories of how, like she was talking about this memorial for some mutual friend who had died. Everybody's on their cell phone. They're not even paying attention. They're fucking somewhere else. They're not there. They're not present with this departed person that they supposedly loved. I mean, it's enormous. That's just a nightmare.
Yeah.
And, you know, if people don't want to see that, if they just want to carry on and have everything get worse on every level, in every sphere, I really think basically that's what's going on. And you said that a while ago, we're going to have to face up to this. Well, we will or we won't. You know, we'll see. You know, maybe people won't. It'll just go on and take some more drugs and get through the day and maybe wonder at the end of their lives what they did with their life, with their energy. What is the meaning of this incredibly, well, anyway... You know my rap, but you know we're down to it. Like you say, we've got to deal or not.
This is a personal question, but you've referenced drugs a couple of times. Do you not drink or smoke or anything?
Oh, I had a problem with alcohol, and I smoked until the 80s, which is about the time I finally got a grip on drinking. And I don't have any temptation now. I have a martini every night.
That's
by
good.
The way, but I don't drain the bottle. You know,
you've learned a discipline. That's actually really respectable, because a lot of people control, especially people who have gone through alcoholism, a lot of people cannot wrangle it in and find the discipline to regulate that their addictions, and they just have to go without it entirely. And then they can't have alcohol ever again because they're just like, once an addict, always an addict, or whatever that phrase is. But you've actually managed to conquer it.
Well, I don't know if I was an alcoholic. I was a heavy drinker, but I don't know. The logic of it, I guess, would say I wasn't an alcoholic. Otherwise, I couldn't just have a drink and you know, go off to bed. I don't know how that works, but I started to scare myself and blackouts, you know, all that sort of thing. Wake up with having fallen and stuff. I was too middle class to let that happen. I've got work to do. I can't go down. I was, after the 60s, I was somewhat grief-stricken. I had friends in prison. Things were really shitty, and I didn't see any prospect for the return of the movement of the 60s. And for a while, I was messed up. But, you know, you got to keep going, I guess.
So it sounds like, in terms of what you think people should be doing, it sounds like you think community is a huge problem. People need to be with each other more. People need to be face to face more, doing things together. It sounds like you think people are working too much. It sounds like you think we're controlled too much. Are these all sounding accurate?
Well, yeah. You know, and getting back to the tech part, I'm on campus working in the library quite a lot here in Eugene, and I'm bummed every day to see how many people seem to be sort of zombies. They just walk along staring at their screen, you know, even bumping into people. I mean, I want to yell and wake up. Look at this world. They're on their phone and they get a job and they're on the screen. They go home and they're on the screen again. I mean, what are we losing? And people really know that. People, I was reading this piece the other day in the New York Times about how people actually are quite bored with it. They're not that distracted or diverted, but they don't know what else, what else to do.
Yeah.
And that's the big problem. What do we do?
People, you're right.
I don't have the answers. I mean, we've got to turn this around and, unplug, but easier said than done.
You're right. When I was on my flip phone last year, I turned my iPhone off and got this shitty little, nobody understood it. Everybody thought I was depressed or something. I was like, no, this is actually what I want to do. There's no problem here. But that was what you just said was the main problem I had. Was I would be waiting in line for food at a restaurant or something, or and my go-to instinct would be to pull out my phone and just check something, you know. But you can't do it when you have a flip phone. And that was part of the exercise, was getting used to observing, looking around, and like you feel like a crazy person because every other person is just looking down at their screen. And when you're the only person that's not doing that, you almost feel like a voyeuristic kind of like creep or something. Like you're just watching people and like the world, but it's like, isn't that sad that that's how you feel? Like it feels less natural to look at what's around you than it does to just look at your little device.
Yeah. And it's sad how fast it changes too. I know you've seen this. Like it used to be a phone, you would speak to people on the phone. Mm-hmm. Now it's texting. We don't even want the human voice over the phone, much less face to face. You know, there's some reaction against that. I was reading about these clubs in Europe that ban, don't use your cell phone in here or take it somewhere else, you know. But I remember I was at the post office here, and I don't know what year this was. It was a while ago. It must have been. I was in line at the post office, and there was this guy talking on his phone. And I turned around and I said kind of loudly, "Does this look like a phone booth to you? Like you're just talking and you're just making noise." And he quietly, I was overdoing it. I shouldn't have yelled at him that way. But now, well, you don't even have to worry about people talking on their phone. You know, as intrusive as that could be, we've already gone past that. I mean, it's really alarming. But, you know, but these are minor things. You know, I have no elevated position, you know, obviously, but some things you can avoid and other things you can't.
You talk in your book a little bit about how language and mathematics are kind of reduction systems for our experience, and they kind of subtract from, they kind of take away from our human experience. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, this is a development that I think bears looking at. You know, when did we need to count things? You know, what is the concept number? Where does it come from? You know, that, for example, or, and I think the initial one, I wrote what turned out to be a series of five explorations, starting with time, language, number, art, so forth. But the consciousness of time is a very, I don't know, I guess you could say treacherous. We're ruled by time now. It's become materialized. It stands over us. That wasn't always the case. I think, and some of this we'll never know, you know, you can't ask people what their consciousness is, somebody a million years ago. But there didn't seem to be any interest in that, measuring time. Why would you do that? So you can see these things come out of the needs of a divided society, an alienated society, the beginnings of domesticated kind of thinking. And maybe we don't need those things. One way to put it is, well, how has it worked out? With symbolic culture, it's more and more a rarefied dimension. How have they helped? Look at where we're at on the planet here. I mean, you can at least conceive of maybe not having those things. What are they for? You know, why are they needed?
Yeah, people didn't need them to get together before they existed. People still had social lives before that stuff existed. It's almost like the only purpose for it is production.
Right, right. Bottom line, I think that's so. So that tells you part of the thing. And I've never really talked about it very much. I've never lectured on the symbolic stuff that I've put forth as you know, possible explorations. But like I said, this new little book called Time and Time Again is the three essays about time, the topic of time. It's always fascinated me. And that's, you know, so many things like we've been talking about, civilization is just a given. Or technology, it's a given. You know, you can't, why question that? Well, why indeed? As we've been saying, you know, now it's become more of a stark problem, and it's past time to be going back to these things or you know, bringing them up in the first place, I suppose.
You've also talked about how domesticated animals have they have a reduced brain size. Like you can take two animals that are like siblings or, you know, relatives, and one is wild and one is domesticated, and the domesticated animal's brain size will actually shrink over time. Mm-hmm. First of all, is that like an evolutionary thing, or is that just like within the life cycle of a specific animal you can actually see this change?
Oh, I don't know, but I would think it's more genetic to create a change.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I suppose. I mean, and you know, Neanderthal had the bigger brains than we do, significantly
right.
bigger.
Right. I'm convinced my wife and her family have Neanderthal descent.
Because
for starters, her brother is like 6'7" and like 200 pounds of muscle. So,
cool.
But yeah, that's something we joke about together. But what I'm getting at is you talk about how it has this effect on humans. This might affect humans in the same way since we're domesticated by civilization. But you could argue that maybe civilization makes our brains sharper because it is production based and we're producing more things, we're collaborating more and we're problem solving more, and maybe that makes us smarter.
Well, of course we have to try to solve these problems, but if you try to measure how well we're doing, it doesn't look too good in my view. You know, that's, and we wouldn't even have to talk about these things, you know, in a disalienated world somehow. You know, you wouldn't spend your time figuring it out or trying to figure it out in some way. You know, you'd just be living. You wouldn't.
Well, the counter argument to all this, to what we're talking about, would be that we're just paranoid.
Well, it's kind of hard to push that one, I would say, very successfully. I mean, we didn't invent these problems. You know, we didn't invent this reality that's worsening, I would say, at a quicker pace all the time. I mean, it's be one thing if, you know, if things were going pretty well, well, no one would, you know, why would they bother with the reading similar stuff? You know, they wouldn't. They just, what's your problem? You're just a griper or whatever. I mean, you know, that would be true, you know, and you wouldn't get anywhere. I don't know if we're getting anywhere. I hope we're beginning to, but, you know, is it okay or isn't it okay? I mean, you know, that's kind of the bottom line thing. Aside from theory and everything, you know, it's, how's it going? Do people feel okay? I mean, there's every pressure to be happy and buy the latest phone or whatever, and then just, you know, because we have to find satisfactions and pleasures wherever we find them, you know. I wrote something, this is probably the most notorious piece, I suppose. It was called The Case Against Art, and I've actually gotten some speaking gigs because people find it rather outrageous. The title was mostly a provocation. It wasn't really anti-art, but it's a question of where that comes from, that satisfaction. I get a lot of pleasure out of art, don't get me wrong, but when did we start needing representation, you know, the symbolic? For example, art, you know, hasn't really saved us, has it? You know, it didn't stop any war or depression or Holocaust or anything else. Can have all the lovely achievements of civilization and literature and everything else, music, philosophy, but hasn't really worked, has it?
Well, yeah, I think maybe you would have to define work, like what would be you'd have to define success, because I would say art makes people feel like their life is okay. I think it makes people feel like they're not alone in a certain way. It makes people feel like their experience is validated.
Well, yeah. And again, you know, one takes pleasure. I'm a big Jackson Pollock fan. I'm just very excited when I see a Pollock. I mean, just it's amazing to me. But it's a kind of compensation, though, isn't it? A consolation. It's the consolation prize for what did you have to trade in to get that? Yeah, it's worth something. We cling to it. We enjoy whatever music, what have you. But maybe we've lost something in the bargain.
What do you think we lost? Something environmental? Something personal?
Well, all those things. Community again, you know. There's the need for certain things, but where does the neediness come from? I mean, you get something out of it. I mean, everybody gets something out of whatever it is. I mean, people wouldn't buy smartphones if they didn't get something out of it. I mean, that's obvious. But at the same time, I think the record isn't very good in terms of the general state of connection or, you know, fulfillment, or however you want to put it. I don't know how you can, it's not a very pretty picture. It's just not. And I wish it was better. I don't like to dwell on the mass shootings or the opioid thing or how apart people seem to be from each other now. I mean, that's extremely tragic, and it's, you know, it's gotten worse. So
are you saying art reminds us of these things?
Well, it can. You know, that's what Adorno stressed. I mean, he said you can't. He was arguing against reconciliation, as he put it. You know, you can't. Society is not resolved. We've got these big problems, and it's false to put the reconciliation out there. You know, the happy face art or whatever. You know, so he felt it was, and I agree. You know, you can find these things that are challenging and remind us of the fact that it is a divided society and an unhealthy place to live, not necessarily in some real explicit, propaganda way. I don't like that sort of thing. But, you know, it's provocative. Some of the best art is, like Beckett, for example, or, you know, they leave you with this feeling of, wow, there's something going on here, or not. You know, in society, you know, yesterday, and I used this on the radio show last week, this global study of air, in fact, it was called Global Air, I think it was called, over 98% of the inhabitants on this planet, human inhabitants, are breathing unsafe air. you know, we've poisoned the planet. You know, it's not like we're all dropping dead tomorrow, but that's, wow. You know, so we just keep on going, just keep on mining and damming and building all this stuff and, you know, pretending that we're fixing things. Over 98%.
Wow.
I suppose some people might quibble with that, but probably not by a whole lot. Mm-hmm. That's staggering.
It is staggering.
And, you know, I've been in places where, because, you know, it does get down to very difficult questions. For example, I was in India, and I'm thinking, you can't breathe the air. What are we doing talking about, you know, concepts and so forth when you can't breathe the air? I was just blown away.
Right. Why? How are people talking about anything?
Yeah. Well, you know what the answer I was getting from that? Development. People have this idea, this wish or fantasy or whatever, they're going to be able to have an air-conditioned apartment, get in their air-conditioned car, and drive to their air-conditioned office. Now, who cares if the air is so toxic you can't breathe it? I mean, that's insane, isn't it? That's just insane. There's a logic to it.
They're saying that their air conditioning is going to filter it out?
Yeah, I guess so, you know.
Wow.
I mean, okay, that's one answer, but so...
So you're just going to stay inside all day?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
We're gonna get even whiter.
Right. And it's a race, and it's, you know, on a national level as well, you know. You've got to compete, you've got to have the latest industry and everything, or else you fall behind, and it's the same for the individual. You've got to get in the rat race and win. You know, that's what we're up against, you know, and that's what I could tell people were thinking, well, you don't want us to be successful. That's what you're really saying. I mean, I don't know if anyone really said that, but, you know, again, how do you define that mm-hmm. in a world that has already defined it? Mm-hmm. You got to make the maximum amount of money and rise in the hierarchy.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
We've covered so much ground that and we've had so much good subject matter here that I think I've gotten a little, off track. We were talking a second ago about, I had asked you to give me the three main problems that you see with civilization today and like the challenges that we have to, the biggest challenges that we have to answer today. And you, the first thing you had said was community and how it's kind of eroding. So what would be the other two things in closing? And then we'll follow that up with three things people can do to help that today.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess... maybe the second one would be the environmental disaster that's certainly arriving already, has arrived. Got to face that. How does that change? And let's see, what would be the third major one? well, I guess that's the personal one. And you could even say that's the spiritual one. What is the, what is a significant life of meaning, of presence, of wholeness? I like to put it in those terms sometimes, you know, that maybe we had that and we don't have that. And I remember one time I gave a talk and this woman said, I think this is a spiritual movement. And I was just floored. I hadn't really thought about that at all. And I went to talk to her after and she had to go catch a bus to get to her home. So I didn't really get to follow up, but I've been thinking about that ever since.
Yeah.
And I like that. I think that's a really important dimension. And too often radicals just dismiss that, like, oh, you're just trying to peddle religion or something. No, it's not necessarily that.
Yeah, spirituality is a word that is kind of polarizing because people who are religious think you're just trying to promote like voodoo, like, you know, unorganized religion. Like they don't like it. You know, they want you to be more orderly. And then on the flip side of the coin, you have people that are non-religious and then you say spirituality and they just assume you're Christian or Catholic or something.
Yeah.
But spirituality is like much more physical, I would say, than a lot of people imagine it to be. I would say that spirituality is probably like quantum or something.
Connecting with the natural world, connecting with the land.
Yeah.
And of course, in a city, you find there's less of that, obviously. And so, yeah, we probably all, even if we can't define it, we sort of locate that somewhere more than somewhere else. You know, I think because that's the indigenous thing, which I think is so important. What's left of that is a lifeline. You know, there is still, that still survives. And there's, to me, that's the concrete connection. I've been able to get to know some people in southern Arizona. It's been a fabulous experience, and I don't claim to, have any depth with that, but I know how important it is. I think it is, speaking of what we've lost and what people try to hang on to now, you know, that's, we too often we just overlook that. And in a lot of ways, I mean, indigenous people, native folks here and there, they're the ones on the front lines against the pipelines and the dams and the mega mines and all that. They are, you know, they have a respect for the land. And that's what we don't have in the dominant society. It's just nothing to except to make money by. That's fundamental.
So what can people do who are, what's like three things people can do? Maybe these people have these concerns they share these concerns that we have, but they're having to, you know, go in and out of a day job every day, and there's not really much they feel like they can do to help solve these problems. What can people like that do without throwing in the towel entirely?
Yeah, which is, yeah, you don't really have that option when, unlike, say, the 60s, there was a lot of ferment and experiment, and, things were moving for a while, really all over the world. So when you don't have that, of course, it's harder. But I think thinking about these things and raising questions, that isn't that hard to do. You know, if you reach these conclusions, bring it up. You know, not everybody has a radio show or a publisher or the interest or the time. But, you can bring it up with friends. You can, you know, simple things, letter to the editor. Conceivably, it starts to break the spell of the monopoly of untruth. Sometimes it doesn't always take that much. Like, you know, the good old Emperor's New Clothes. Finally, the little kid says, but he doesn't have any clothes. And suddenly, the spell is broken. I mean, I'm getting a little giddy there, but you know what I mean? You can try to raise something and see what happens. And
it's got to be okay for us to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I've been surprised by how much people already have thought about it, but they don't feel like, you don't hear about it on TV or elsewhere, so you just kind of keep it to yourself. I mean,
people carry this, and it's like a weight on their shoulder, and they don't know what to do with it, you know. But they, I think it's partly because of how polarized things are now with social media. People only see what they want to see, and so it makes people. It ruins friendships, it pulls people apart, and you know, that's like a bigger problem than ever with the internet. But we've got to find ways to break through that. We've got to find ways to talk to people we disagree with. And, you know, I have people on this show all the time I don't agree with. That's half the point. You know, like the conversation is so important. We've all just got to be cool with talking to each other, even if somebody says something we don't like. We can't get all hissy pissy and insecure about it.
Oh, well put. Yeah, that's the bottom line. And that goes back to community. You know, then you're trying to reconnect, trying to reestablish some community there, and you got to start.
Well, John, thanks so much for making the time for this. This was, I enjoyed it so much. And,
me too, Julian.
Great talking with you and hearing your ideas. And let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, best luck with Spellbound. That's a very important project.
Thank you. Maybe next time we'll do this in person as opposed to using all this technology. What do you think about John and his ideas about our economical and environmental predicament? I want to hear your thoughts, so involve yourself in the conversation. That's what this entire podcast is about. And I think it's the most important thing any of us can do is talk about it. That's why I'm just simply talking about these ideas with these guests that are coming on the podcast. And, we all can involve ourselves in this conversation. So be sure to do that. And if you want to send me something longer, I would love to hear from you. hello@spellboundshow.com. That's where you can send it. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. That way your phone will always stay up to date. You don't have to do any work to remember. The computers will remember for you. Kind of the antithesis of this entire episode. But hey, I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. I'm loving this. This is the highlight of my week each week. So I hope you guys are enjoying it too. And I look forward to next Monday, as always.